Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And our guest this week is Tom Terwilliger. And Tom was one of the best amateur bodybuilders in the 1980s. He competed in the Nationals in 1984, 85, and 86. And then he got his pro card at the 86 MPC Nationals by winning the light heavyweight class. And he competed in a couple Olympias, including the 1989 Mr. Olympia in Rimini, Italy. And then he was also in the 1991 Mr. Olympia in Atlanta, Georgia. So I had a chance to hook up with Tom at the Mr. Olympia Expo a couple weeks ago and have been friends with him on Facebook. And he's a very nice guy, very friendly, and never got a chance to meet him. So it was a pleasure meeting him. He came by the Old School Labs booth. And so I got him to do an interview for us. So it was such a long interview, we're actually making it two parts. And today we're going to have part one where Tom will talk about his early days in bodybuilding, which was pretty cool because he talks about training in New York as only a teenager. He saw Steve Mihalik and Tony Pandolfo and a lot of great East Coast champions. And then he competed in a lot of teenage competitions. And we talk about some of the guys he competed against there. And then we go all the way up into his amateur days when he was competing in the MPC Nationals. And as I said, he competed in 84 when Rich Gaspari won his class, and then 85 when he took second to Phil Williams, who went on to win the overall, and then, of course, 86, where he beat out Mike Ashley for the title. So we got a great interview coming up with Tom Terwilliger. And I do want to mention that we are brought to you by Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn. This is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe title in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is now the two-time Classic Physique Olympia champion, and he's also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. And of course, Breon just won his second title at the Olympia. Well, a week ago, really. It was only last weekend. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banoot and, of course, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12. And you will receive 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com or go to amazon.com and you can order your products there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. Speaking of Old School Labs, they're having a big celebration from Breon's win and they're going to have a discount at Amazon. So just use the Amazon code Breon Mr. O. So that's B-R-E-O-N Mr. O. And you will get 20% off of any products that you order off of Amazon for oldschoollabs.com. All right, so how's everybody doing out there? We are now heading into almost the end of September. This year is really flying by fast. I was able to kind of get back to normal this week. I had to go right back to work right after the Olympia, so it's been kind of a hectic week for me. But actually tomorrow, Monday, I'm really going to start serious training because I've been dieting pretty much on and off all year. And now I'm getting close, so I'm going to hit it really hard for the next couple months, and I'm going to do some photo shoots, maybe in October, but if not October, definitely November. And I want to show what I look like at 55 years young, and I think I'm going to look really good this year. So I'm training hard, and I'm almost there, but I got that last inch, maybe in a quarter, to lose off my waist. So it looks good, but it's not quite there. You guys know how that is. If you just got a little bit of fat on your waist, it just ruins it. So I'm getting close. So I'm going to really buckle down starting tomorrow, hit the diet real hard, hit the cardio harder, and train really hard. And hopefully I'll be there in another 4 weeks. I had some bad news at the gym I go to, Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club out in Tampa, Florida. We lost one of our members His name was Scott Goldstein, and Scott was younger than me. I think he was only in his 40s. One of those guys who's just always smiling, very positive, kind of guy you hate to see go, but he died of testicular cancer. I moved to Florida in 2010, so I've been here 8 years, and I think I met Scott probably maybe 6 months after I moved here at the old Powerhouse Gym in downtown Tampa, Florida. And I was talking to him because he had this, looked like a, he had blood taken out or something. He had something on his arm, like a cotton ball or something that was taped to his arm. So I asked him what happened, and he said he was getting blood drawn because he had stage 4 testicular cancer. And I think this was in 2011. And I was like, wow, I mean, what are you going to do? And he's like, nothing I can do. You know, I'm just going to keep going. So for the next few years, you never would have known he was sick. I mean, he's competed in men's physique competitions out here in Florida. And just always, like I said, a real positive guy, very happy guy. And he just kind of went right through the chemo treatments and just kept going to the gym and kept living his lifestyle. He said that's what really saved him. That's what really made the whole process easier for him, was going to the gym and having that release for him. But eventually, unfortunately, I caught up to him. And the last few times I saw Scott, he was wearing one of those oxygen things in his nose and carrying the oxygen tube with him into the gym. And he did finally pass away this last week. So my condolences to all his friends and family. He was one of those really good guys that you hate to see go away. But he was very, very courageous. He never complained about it. Just went to the gym and pushed through. Never, ever talked about his illness, and just kept training as long as he could for as long as he could. And eventually his time was up. So rest in peace, Scott Goldstein. We're all going to miss you over at the Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club in Tampa. My books, which include Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1, and the MP6 Workout. You can buy all those books either through me or you can get them at Amazon.com. And by the time you hear this, these books will be available in Kindle as well as in paperback. So if you're one of those people who prefers to read your books in Kindle, you can buy now my books, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1, and Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder and the MP6 Workout. All three will be available in Kindle at Amazon.com. And I still have that sale going on for a couple more weeks. It's until October 1st. All three books are only $50. So if you want to purchase them from me, you can get all three books for only $50. And this is going on until October 1st. So yeah, actually only got about a week left. So if you want to get that deal in, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And you can pay by PayPal through that email. But yeah, just send that email to me and I will send those books out to you. If you want them for yourself or for others, you can do that. And like I said, this is only going to go on for another week or so. So no emails about the Sean Ray interview, unfortunately. So we don't have any emails to read. I did get a couple emails about some YouTube comments. This one was about the Boyer Co. Comment. I had a short video on my YouTube channel. It was called Boyer Co. Why the 1980 Mr. Olympia was not on TV. And Johann Schultz said, I didn't have Arnold winning either when I watched the individual routines. He looked thin and emaciated from my perspective. And by far, he was not at his trademark best that night. But I made the mistake of comparing the 1980 Arnold with the 1975 Arnold, or the 74 Arnold, or even the 73 Arnold. The appropriate thing to do was to compare the 1980 Arnold with the 1980 Olympia lineup that was standing on stage that night right beside him. It's not about, is Arnold at his best or not? That idea is totally irrelevant. The object of the game was to have the best physique on stage on the night of the contest when compared to the other competitors. And even though Arnold was not at his best that night, and even though he came up lacking in the individual rounds, he absolutely destroyed the competition when the comparative round came up. Arnold was a full head taller and even a full head and shoulders taller when standing side by side. He was as much as 40% wider than Mike Mentzer was, and no one could even come close to compare with his level of density outside of Roy Callender. When you put a good big man up against a great small man in bodybuilding, the good big man is going to win. No, it isn't fair. In order to beat a really good man, the small man has to be near perfect. Arnold's wow factor really became apparent in the comparison round, and he literally made everyone else look small. He was a monster among men that night, even though he wasn't at his best. There can be no question that politics were involved in the decision. The movie Conan was good for bodybuilding, and what's good for bodybuilding is to promote the star of the film as the current champion of the sport. And what's good for bodybuilding is ultimately good for Joe Weider. Arnold is on the cover of the magazines. Joe sells more magazines and phony supplements as a result, and all is right with the world. But if politics hadn't been involved in the 1980 Mr. Olympia decision, Arnold would have won anyway. Lou was no longer on stage, and everybody else was just too small to overcome both the height, the size, and the larger-than-life persona. All right, thanks, Johan, for that long email. That was about on my YouTube channel. And then Johan also had a comment about the Bodybuilding Legends show number 28, which was the Eddie Robinson interview part one. And he says, I hate those old school slow jam posing routines that Sean Ray would engage in. He was an excellent poser and he had a fantastic physique, but those old school soulful Motown posing routines would literally put the viewer to sleep. Just too slow and deliberate. No excitement or high points at all. All right. Thank you for that comment. I disagree with that. Actually, I think Sean's posing was awesome, whether he posed his slow music or fast music. Just check out his 1990 Pro Ironman Invitational win, which I think was one of his best posing routines ever, and that was to Luther Vandross. But thanks for your comment. And then we did get some comments also because Old School Labs posted the recap videos with me and Samir Banute and Tom Platz. So those got a lot of comments, even though they weren't my videos. And this one guy, Lo Ho, says, you got to love Samir and Platz. Two genuinely nice, well-spoken, crazy in a good way, though, polished old-timer champions. The Olympia was amazing this year with a phenomenal Breon Ansley and a phenomenal Sean Roden. This year will definitely go into the books as the new school meets the old school. This was the year when bodybuilding, the posing, the presentation became art again with a capital A. We can only hope for this trend to continue. An amazing weekend never to forget. And then Lee Solid said, classic physique look also won in the open men's. Great year for bodybuilding. Hussein Absir said, Breon is a real champ. Even though everything is against him, he finds a way to win. Fans want Bumstead to win, not based on his physique, but other reasons. Judges put Breon ahead by 1 point, even though Bumstead looked worse than last year. Despite all this, he still found a way to win. Real champ. Luke Trong said, congratulations. I knew you had it. The only disappointment was you not sporting that classic afro. He's talking about Breon Ansley, of course. That would have been freaking game over even faster. Filmian Fitness said, I predicted Breon Ansley was going to win, and he ended up winning. George P. said, I'd love to see these guys at the Arnold Classic Australia in 2019. Yeah, I'd love that too. Maybe we can get Old School Labs to send us out to Australia. That'd be awesome. Judy Cameron said, I love seeing Samir and Tom discuss things together. Two great champions and even greater personalities. Legends. William Hill said, it's not even close. He had them beat by a long shot from the leg cuts to the biceps. Everyone always wants the next best thing. Chris is not there. He just looks good because of his size difference. But shape and round muscles, Breon has it all. Honest Conscience Dave said, well-earned and well-deserved repeat win by Breon Ansley, and it's fun to have Samir and Tom analyzing and critiquing everything. Richard Bell said, I told you, Samir, that Breon wants to win. I saw it, and prejudging his legs and his biceps, his deltoids, everything just stood out. This was a great, blessed year in bodybuilding. The Real Captain said, the perfect champion, just such a great role model for the sport. Congratulations, Breon. Troy Coleman said, the original old schooler giving it up to the classic guy, a wonderful sight. Seal said, congratulations to Breon and Old School Labs for this well-deserved victory. Valdik Lim said, congratulations to Breon. Also great to see Samir and Tom mentoring him. Bamber Baby said, old school all the way, baby. LOL said, it was honestly so obvious. Breon had it 100% and definitely will take the next one or two as well. Andre Drapiza said, Breon brought it. Even though him and C-Bum were only separated by a point, I think the gap between first and second was a little bigger this year. I agree with that, by the way, Andre. I love seeing how giddy and excited the Lion and Eagle are. Keep it old school. Breon brought an amazing package to the Olympia this year and totally deserved to win. Congrats. So that was one of the videos that we had on Old School Labs. And then the other one was our Olympia recap where we talked about the men's open bodybuilding. And Flex Rose said, legends are speaking the truth right here. Single Lamas said, I love Samir, but he does like to talk. John still looks very well built and healthy. Matt Rothschild said, I love hearing these guys breaking it down where what they're saying is so true. Anabolic 2K said three Mr. O's, Natural O, 1983 Mr. O, and Tom is the uncrowned Mr. O, 1981. That's true. Honest Conscious Dave made a comment on this. He said, this is the greatest event to happen in bodybuilding in over a decade and up there with the best ever. Sean Roden, aesthetic, proportion, symmetrical, great lines and waist, and at 43 years of age, an ectomesomorph like a taller modern Frank Zane, coming back from two life-threatening ulcers and six blood transfusions months ago. 10 to 12 years ago, Roden struggled after his father passed away. He battled alcohol and depression issues. To come from that backdrop story and do what Sean did is the modern-day American dream. Great family support and driven. That's true inspiration for someone like me rebuilding my own life at 46. Props also go to Raleigh, well-deserved people's champ, and Brandon Curry, arguably the most improved. This bodes well for 2019, a new Mr. Olympia ambassador, and we'll see if Phil comes roaring back to fix his waistline, and maybe even Kai Green comes a calling as he's 3 months younger than Roden. Last chances coming, turning 44 next year. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I talked about this on my Facebook page. Sean Roden was the oldest Mr. Olympia. Him and Chris Dickerson were both 43 years old when they won their Mr. Olympia title. But since Sean was born in April and Chris is born in August, Sean actually is older by a couple months. So Sean Roden is the oldest Mr. Olympia winner ever. But that's interesting. This guy, Honest Conscience Dave, said that if Kai Green comes back next year, he'll win at 44 years old. So that's an interesting trivia question. This guy says, I love these three. They are great. It's funny that the natural Mr. O is the biggest one physically now in later years, but they all look great and are obviously healthy. Would love to have some beers with these guys and listen to some stories. Tom about the golden era and just after. Samir about the 80s when I think bodybuilders look the best. And Hansen is virtually an encyclopedia of bodybuilding knowledge. Robin Uterlinden said, Samir is right about the modern way of tanning. Everybody looks the same and often way too dark. White people almost looks the same as dark people. I like the golden era tanning much more. Andre Drapiza said, Hansen said, what do you think about posing overall? And Samir said, you know, they can't pose better than us. LOL, love it. Nate says, Samir needs to let someone else talk for a second. Giovanni said, is John Hansen making a comeback? He looks like he's hiding some mass under that shirt. No, I'm not making a comeback, but I am going to do some photo shoots. Honest Conscience Dave said, just like they had a tall class, short class, or an over or under 200 class in the 1975 through 1978 Olympias. Actually, it was the 79 Olympias also. I think it would be great for the fans, at least as an exhibition, to have the 212 winner, Lewis, face off against open winner, Roden, for the ultimate people's champion favorite face-off. They did it with Arnold and Franco in 75, Franco and Ken Waller in 76. Create that, at least fans, a final pose-off between two class winners. Great analysis by John, Samir, and Tom, and lots of fun old-school style. All right, so those are some of the comments on the YouTube channel for the old-school labs videos that me and Samir and Tom Platz did. And if you guys have any comments about this podcast, please send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com and I will read them on the air. You know, I love getting comments from you guys. So if you have any comments about this interview with Tom Terwilliger or any suggestions you have about any guests that you want to hear from, send those out to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I also want to mention we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their brand new website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, it's flalternativemeds.com, or call them at their office number, which again is 813-922-8939, and you will get a free consultation from them if you tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. or you will get 20% off your order. All right, so that is it for our opening, guys. Here is our interview with Tom Terwilliger, one of the best amateur bodybuilding champions from the 1980s, right here on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Enjoy. All right, welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, and my special guest this week is a champion bodybuilder in his own right. His name is Tom Terwilliger, and Tom was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1980s, and then he won the light heavyweight class at the 1986 MPC Nationals and became a professional bodybuilder and competed in the Mr. Olympia. So it's great to have you on the line, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
I got to tell you, the pleasure is all mine. Natural Mr. Olympia, great champion. I mean, I've certainly known you for quite some time, not personally, but certainly through the bodybuilding community, and had the great pleasure of meeting you just the other day at the Mr. Olympia competition in the Expo Hall. And I'll tell you something, you lived up to my expectations and truly were a gentleman. So the pleasure all mine, without question.
It was great meeting you. We've known each other for a while on Facebook, and That's right. That was the first time we got to know each other in person, so that was great meeting you, too. Glad you came back.
Thank you very much.
Well, Tom, you've had a long bodybuilding career, and I know you were back in the good old days of bodybuilding, which is what we like to talk about on the podcast. So if you could just tell us how you got started in bodybuilding. What age were you, and what was your inspiration to begin bodybuilding?
Well, it's interesting. I was a teenager when I started bodybuilding, young, probably around 14 or so. And and I had been lifting and playing lacrosse like a lot of young guys. I was an athlete. But I didn't – it's interesting because I never really excelled at team sports. I wrestled. I played lacrosse, soccer, but never really excelled at it. Even though I suspected I was a decent athlete, it was just something there that just didn't inspire me, being part of that kind of team. I don't know why. I mean, certainly today, I'm a great team player with my business and my business associates, my wife with my partner. But back then, it just didn't spark anything in me. But I was lifting, especially playing lacrosse. I mean, you had to buff up. I was maybe one of the skinniest kids you ever saw. I mean, it was just, I don't know how much I weighed at that. And I guess I was in probably around seventh grade or so when I started playing lacrosse, and just real skinny, had to start lifting. So a bunch of us got together. We had some weights at this guy's house. We developed a little gym at my house, back at the house. And I remember distinctly, very specifically, that one of my teammates, who was kind of into the bodybuilding thing, and occasionally we would see some magazines, we'd get a little inspired, came to my homeroom. The bell rang. He was like already standing outside, and he had a magazine. It was Muscle Builder magazine at the time, which is now Muscle and Fitness. And on the cover was this guy. You know, with this, I mean, he had this thing they call the arm blaster wrapped around his chest, and he was doing these curls. And of course, he had this split in his teeth, and he's grunting and grinding. Veins are popping out. And I saw this, and I started flipping through the magazine and was immediately inspired. Of course, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
At the time, remember that cover? Yeah.
You remember that cover? At the time, I didn't know who the hell he was. Nobody knew who he was outside the bodybuilding community. But I think we were about the same age. You probably saw the same cover.
Yeah, I remember those old Muscle Builders. Those are really inspirational.
Yeah, and that inspired me. So I'm flipping through, and of course, they were all black and white photos by Artie Zeller, who just meandered around the gym. I had an opportunity to meet Artie Zeller, such a great photographer, some years later before he died. Took me to his home, showed me the incredible library of black and whites that had been printed but never published. And it was it was an extraordinary journey. Oh, it really was. It was certainly one of the great moments in my life in terms of the bodybuilding, because I knew of his work and had seen it so many times in Muscle and Fitness, Muscle Builder. And so I was truly inspired by that magazine, that cover, and began training for a totally different reason, not to buff up for lacrosse or to be stronger or more athletic, but to start putting on muscle, to start. I almost knew at that moment, there was another defining moment shortly thereafter, but I knew in that moment this is something that resonated with me, something I truly wanted to do. And that was my initial inspiration.
So it was love at first sight.
Oh, absolutely. And then you know, I started training at, it was a typical athletic, it wasn't even an athletic club, really. It was just like a local gym that was right next to my high school. It was called Iron Master, although it didn't live up to its name, Iron Masters. It was just like a little rinky thing. Not in the least, a great name. I love the name, but it did not live up to it. Anyway, it was a place to train. But then a new place had opened up. In Amityville, we've all heard of the Amityville Horror, and I was living in Long Island. Well, this gym was called Future Man, and it was indeed the true Amityville Horror. Because, I mean, I was 15 when I first walked in, and the thing that struck me most was the pungent smell of what I then I became aware that it was a combination of Bengay, vomit, and sweat. And it was like, you know, getting hit with smelling salts. I walked in, I was right. Like, oh my God, holy mackerel. and that became my home for the next few years. And actually, that day that I walked into that gym, another legendary bodybuilder who's since passed, Steve Mahalik, who was at the time AAU Mr. America. You remember Steve, right?
Sure, sure.
I mean, intensity or insanity? Well,
yeah.
Unfortunately,
right.
I think there was as much insanity as there were intensity in his training and his life, certainly. But he was there. He had just competed in or was just about to compete in the Mr. America or the Mr. Universe. And he was there, and he was doing a photo shoot with a guy named Bob Gruskin, who later became a little bit of a mentor of mine. You remember Bob's photos and all his work? Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Bob.
And I think it was Muscular Development, one of the magazines he was doing photos for. And of course, Steve, in his classic way, had, you know, like, and this is what we used to wear in those days. Nobody had the nice workout wear that we have today, you know. I mean, nobody was wearing, you know, the spandex. What they were wearing then were the old, beat up old sweatpants. They had holes in them. They looked like you crapped in them. And I mean, it was just like you wore them again and again and again and again, and you didn't wash them. Well, Steve was wearing those kind of sweatpants, and on top he had like an old wife beater that had more holes than it had material, and was like just yellow with sweat. But the guy looked unbelievable. I mean, for a 15-year-old kid walking in the door, it was one of the most inspiring. And it was also one of those moments where I said, I doubt that I could ever do that. How could I ever look like that? Just impossible.
Right.
But as soon as I found out he was Mr. America, that became a very specific goal and objective. It was like I planted it in my unconscious mind at that moment, and that was the goal. That was what I was seeking. And And that was my second inspiration, and it certainly endured for several years.
Describe some of our younger listeners out there, Tom, describe what the gym was like, because I try to tell these young kids what the gyms in the 70s and 80s were like, because they were so hardcore and small gyms. They definitely weren't appealing to the general public, right? They were just for bodybuilders and powerlifters.
Absolutely. In fact, the whole place was just filled with Future Man, you know, as it was only open for about a year or so when I had found out about it, and it housed, including Steve Mahalik, Tony Pandolfo, John Girolamo, many of the guys from New York that was the top bodybuilders and powerlifters. And it was interesting because back in those days, John, as you remember, it was sort of like it was a bodybuilding, powerlifting. It was like they were all in the same environment, but it wasn't that they didn't get along, but there was like a rivalry. The powerlifters couldn't understand what the hell the bodybuilders were doing. What are they all paying attention, looking in the mirror constantly? And the bodybuilders couldn't understand why these guys took half-hour breaks and had coffee between every set.
Right.
I mean, it was like, what are they doing? But we all managed to sort of get along and make it all happen and inspired each other to a certain degree. So you walked in. When I walked into Future Man was a very sort of typical – small bodybuilding gym. Couldn't have been more than 3,000, maybe less than that, 2,500, 3,000 square feet. So a small environment.
Right.
The first thing that you noticed after the smell when you walked in was on the left-hand side was a very small room that had very state-of-the-art, already rusty and beat up Nautilus equipment. If you remember the old Nautilus stuff, it had all chains and it was Arthur Jones had created this stuff, and Mike Mensah was sort of inspiring people to use it. But it rarely got used, but it was in there. It had its own little room. And then once you got past that, the vast majority of – there were some mirrors, certainly. Most of the mirrors, you couldn't really see that they were mirrors because they were just too steamed up and full of spit from squatting and everything else going on.
Right.
So, you know, you barely could see the mirror. And usually there was carpet that was completely soaked with either vomit or sweat or something else. Who knows what? People's water, protein drinks and stuff. But all the equipment in this particular place was black with red vinyl. And most of it looked like it was homemade. Like the welds were still exposed. It was very narrow metal. Although intimidating – and certainly beyond comprehension in terms of what the hell half these things could possibly do for a 15-year-old kid, certainly very simplistic in their design the decor, there was no particular decor. Usually there's a brick wall, and there might be, if the place had been established for a while, there might be an entire row across the entire, like a foot down from the ceiling, 5-6 feet up from the floor, just above the mirror. There might be a row of pictures, photographs of all the top champions at that time. There's always pictures and always some trophies hanging around. Not much of a front desk. But that's about it. But it was a very hardcore, very intimidating environment for someone who wasn't like either devoted or inspired or had some sort of desire to really truly build muscle and was willing to do whatever it takes. I think most people would walk into that Future Man, like many of the other gyms back in those days, and just kind of turn around and walk out again, which is not the environment.
You know? It's funny you say not that. That
it wasn't, not that it wasn't friendly, John. I mean, remember, it wasn't overly friendly, certainly, because most of those guys didn't want some neophyte taking the equipment or jumping on a piece of equipment when they're trying to superset. I mean, the other thing that really stuck out in my mind, and you've experienced this, is the same with my training, is guys, they were supersetting back in those days. And I remember Tony Pandolfo and John Girolamo, who was another great champion from Long Island, when they supersetted, they didn't meander from one machine to the other. They ran from one machine to the next. And God forbid you jumped on that leg press and they were ready to jump in on a leg. Forget it. The shit would hit the fan and that would be it. And that was the kind of environment. That was the environment. But it was incredibly conducive to what the job we had ahead of us was, which was enduring extreme amounts of pain and discomfort, staying focused, not allowing distractions to come into your world while you were on your quest. And that was extraordinarily conducive to it. Today's environment, not quite as much, not quite as conducive.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the gym I trained at when I was a teenager. And I remember like a couple other guys my age, teenagers, would not go into that gym until they trained at home for a couple of years because it was so intimidating to walk in there, you know. And it was real serious. Like you had to earn the respect of those guys in there. They weren't going to be nice to you. You know, they were older and bigger and stronger. And I don't care if you were a 14 or 15 year old kid, they didn't treat you with, you know, they weren't nice to you. And you had to earn their respect, and you earned it by training hard, you know.
I remember that very specifically, without question. And I remember the day Tony Pandolfo sort of even acknowledged me. Well, the first day I trained there. I should tell you the stories real quick. The very first day I trained at Future Man, I went in there at peak hour. I rode my bicycle. It took me about 40 minutes or so to ride my bicycle there. And it was freezing cold outside. It was like winter. And I went in, and I had read somewhere that Arnold used to eat about a dozen hot dogs. I'm probably exaggerating, but he ate like a dozen hot dogs after he worked out, right? Certainly this wasn't pre-contest training, but like in the off season. So I read that, and of course I had a better idea. I was going to eat a half a dozen or so hot dogs before I worked out. So you can imagine, right? I'm in there, I'm hyperventilating, I can't breathe because I'm trying to keep up, trying to earn the respect, and I threw up all over the guy's gym. First day. Yeah, what was interesting, so that was the first time Tony Pandolfo, the owner, even remotely acknowledged me, and all he did was just walk up with the mop and some rags and said, clean it up, and walked away, as if it was a daily occurrence. I was like, it happens every day.
Nothing new here.
The second time he acknowledged me was, I guess I'd been training about a year there, and was doing, I'm really, you know, picking up, you know, what guys were doing and how they were doing it, and modeling the truly great champions that I was surrounded by. And Tony came up and said, hey, you're starting to look a little thicker. That was it. And I think that meant I went from about 140 pounds to 146 or so. It wasn't terribly impressive, but at least he acknowledged it at that point, which was pretty cool for me.
So what got you into competing then, Tom? When did you start doing the competitions?
Well, actually, it was during those years at Tony Pandolfo's Future Man gym. You know, Tony was competing, and I saw other guys competing as well, coming home with trophies. And there were some teenage bodybuilding competitions, and I can't remember what was the first one that actually inspired me to do this. Because let's face it, it is something that's pretty esoteric, pretty out there for the most part. The first time, you know, slipping on a pair of those Speedos and getting up on stage in front of, at that time, it wasn't hundreds of people. It was probably just dozens of people, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty bizarre. And even getting it passed by mom was like, she was completely unsure about the entire thing, you know? And so as a teenager, I guess something must have sparked and that unconscious thought that if I'm going to become Mr. America, then I got to start somewhere. And my first contest, I think I was 17. I've been training about a year and a half or so. And my first contest was the Teenage Colonial America in West Orange, New Jersey at the high school.
Okay. And,
I mean, it was such – compared to what we saw this weekend or last weekend at the Olympia, it was such a different environment because it was just, you know, it was just like a little podium placed in the middle of a basketball court and like a little light hanging – like one little light hanging overhead, you know?
Right,
and
right.
And some fold a bunch of fold out chairs, and that was it.
Yeah.
And and so I managed to take third. Interestingly enough, Mike Torsha, you may have heard of Mike. Mike won.
He's a good teenage champion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it actually really was a great teenage champion. He won that weight class. He won that that division. I took third, which was extraordinarily surprising. But you had a bunch of guys. You had a bunch of guys in there that were really good. Ronnie Tufel, who went on to be, you know, compete in the America. I don't know if he ever won the America. He might have. There was a bunch of other guys there that really inspired me. And of course, getting up there, you know, finding the balls, excuse the expression, to get up and make that happen just inspired me. It was the next. I immediately set my sights on the next one, and then the next one.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I had found
actually. I'm looking at the results of that. I'm looking on the internet right now. And yeah, Ron Magnum won the teen.
That's
and
right.
And he won the medium class. And Dwayne Broadway, I remember him. He was second.
Oh, my God. Both those guys.
Yeah. And Mike
Torcher
won your class. And you got third. And then in the open men, like you said, Ron Tufel won the short. And Tony Pandolfo was in. He got second. And Claude Regan, I remember him, too. He got third.
Right. Oh, my. All those names sound so familiar. And they were – because they did that whole circuit. Most of those guys were the East Coast competitors, and they did all that circuit around there. Now, of course, it was the AAU at the time.
Yeah, right.
So I wound up competing with all those guys repeatedly again and again. And they were always inspiring, and it was great. And Ron Tufel was just, I mean, although he lacked, you know, certainly the genetic shape that would make for a great champion today, he had everything else, and his abdominals and his sheer muscularity.
Yeah, he had to look great, huh?
Yeah, he really was, man. Wow.
And then Ron Magnum took second in the medium class, so, man, he had to be a good teenager.
He was. Ron Magnum was fantastic. Dwayne Broadway, same thing. These guys all, you know, they all excelled. And I'll tell you what, it was quite a thrill because, again, those are the guys that I first went head-to-head up against. You know, ultimately, eventually, certainly not in that contest. They were far more advanced than I was. In fact, I look back at those pictures, and I was a pretty skinny kid still, with too much hair. I wish I had that hair today, quite frankly.
Right.
But it was pretty thrilling to ultimately, you know, compete against those guys closer to the national level, and win. And so to beat some of those guys, it was like, wow. It was like a marker for me. It was like, this is progress. I'm beating the guys that were inspiring me early on, and that was a pretty cool experience.
So after that first one, Tom, did you just keep going? Did you just keep doing more teenage shows?
I did. I went on competed. What was the Colonial America? Then it was the Mr. Apollo. There was a whole bunch of other. Let's see, what else? The big one as a teenager. There were two big ones as a teenager. The Southern USA. I got invited down by Doc Neely down to, I think it was in Georgia, to compete.
Yeah, actually, Doc Neely.
The competition was down in New Orleans, but I got invited down to Georgia to train at his gym, and that was a pretty cool, interesting experience. Won that, and then went on to win the teenage Metropolitan Championship against John Defendez. Do you remember John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that contest, too, the Metropolitan. I remember seeing it in magazines all the time. Yeah.
The Mets was an interesting show because so many guys, Dennis Tenorino, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pandolfo, a lot of guys that went on to win the America, I think Steve Mahalik might have been one of them, had won that. So that show became sort of like a legacy show. And if you could do well in that as a teenager, certainly as an open, and I went on many years later to win the open, you were making your mark, you might say, you know, at least in that that New York City area. So I went on to win the teenage Metropolitan, and then the career took a sort of, I can't say it took a nosedive, but it took a hiatus, and it wasn't necessarily, wasn't a good one. It was, I was going down a really bad path, really bad road. After that,
oh, really?
It was interesting because I said I was going to take a couple of weeks off. A couple of weeks off led to a couple of months, led to a few years, and it was about 5 or 6 years or so before I got back in. And
really? Wow.
And honestly, God, thank goodness for bodybuilding, because I was headed down a really bad path. I got my first Harley Davidson as a senior in high school, and chopped it out. And there's no one to ride a Harley with in high school. So I started riding in Manhattan and stopping at all the bars that had bikes in front of them. And of course, you know, if you look back in the late 70s, you know, if you're riding a Harley Davidson in the late 70s in New York City, at the time, which wasn't a great place to hang out, it was you were connecting with the wrong people. And that's exactly what I did. I hooked up and connected with some really not such good people. And for the next 5 years, I wound up riding with this crazy outlaw bike club. And, and man, I wouldn't change a thing today, but it really could have went in a bad, really bad direction. And so I thank God I had bodybuilding and some good values and good family to fall back on and to pull me out of that. So then bodybuilding, I got back into bodybuilding is what saved me, what really pulled me back out of that thing. It was like, hey, first place I got to go when I leave this world is back into the gym and start rebuilding the body. And that's what
made you decide to leave that world? Was there anything that happened that said, I got to get out of here?
Yeah, actually there was. I was already vacillating. And, you know, sometimes, as you know, sometimes when you have to make a profound decision, it can be tough. It's not easy to change or to take that leap of faith, you might say, whether it's to walk away from a bad relationship or an abusive relationship or a business that's just you know, bleeding money or any number of things that you feel as if you've been committed to or made a commitment to. And having to make that profound decision to leave it or to do something different can be tough. And a lot of times what happens is we vacillate on that. And I did. I knew within the first 2 years, 2.5 years in that lifestyle that this was not me. This was not what I should be doing. It's not who I should be. I went into that thinking this is about camaraderie, brotherhood, and strength, you know, and all that. And it just really, it's as we know, I don't need to say too much about it, but as we know, it's not. And so I knew that within the first couple of years or even sooner, but it took me a while because these were my brothers. These were my compadres, you might say. And so walking out, as you can imagine, isn't that easy. Plus, is, you know, once you're involved in that kind of thing, it's not so easy to walk away. There's a price to pay, you might say. And but I remember very specifically, and I'll keep the story very brief, but I remember I was at the clubhouse. And, you know, we were always at the clubhouse partying or riding or raising hell somewhere. And we were at the clubhouse this particular night. And I remember distinctly that I was looking in the mirror across the way. And the clubhouse, by the way, was just some old warehouse. The bar that I was leaning against was just nailed together, plywood and 2x4s. And there was an old mirror and some bottles behind it. And I remember leaning against it, looking at that mirror and looking at myself. And I couldn't have been more than 23 years old or so at the time. Or 23, 24. And I remember looking around at the guys I thought were my brothers and just looking, and they looked beat up, worn out. And I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I'm like, holy crap, that's exactly what I look like. And this is the direction I'm
heading.
I remember, man, I remember like a voice going off in my head saying, literally, it was like it's whispering in my ear, you're done, walk away.
I
heard it like at least twice, you're done, walk away. And it was so powerful, yet so subtle, like a whisper. My guardian angel or God or something, or even my unconscious mind telling me, this is it. This is the time. This is the time. Make the decision now. And I did. And I turned and I walked and I was headed towards the door. And, you know, of course, like with any decision, sometimes you glance back and just to make sure you're doing the right thing. And I did. And in that moment of glancing back, someone must have pushed up against the bar. Mm-hmm. And behind the bar, there was a loaded double barrel shotgun. It was cocked and ready to go because these guys never knew what to expect. Right. And it hit the ground, both barrels went off and blew a massive hole in the very spot that I was standing, no more than 10 seconds. before.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
And it was incredible. I was frozen. I was frozen. Of course, the entire room erupted. Guns are out. Yeah. Everybody, no one knew what was happening. Everybody down on the ground. And I'm just seeing this thing in the glass, in the wood, the fragments of splinters everywhere. And it was at that moment that it was just like it solidified that this decision that my conscience, my guardian angel, God, someone gave me the message that I had to walk away at that moment. And if I hadn't, John, I wouldn't be here today. I just simply wouldn't.
Wow.
And so it was a powerful message to listen yeah. when you and trust yourself, trust God, trust the process. And when you're vacillating on something, you know deep down inside what decision you need to make.
Right.
And the sooner you make it, the better. The sooner you make it, the faster you'll walk away with whatever you have left intact.
Yeah.
And I did. So I left. I walked out that door. I had to leave my motorcycle behind, most of my possessions. Very few people supported me in doing that because most of them, you know, were in the club. And like I said, the first stop after leaving that lifestyle, back to the gym. And it was my savior. It was what created a new sense of community, a new sense of purpose, began to rebuild my beaten and tattered 23-year-old body, for God's sake. and it was a new beginning. And it was a very powerful beginning. And it led to the commitment it took to become a national bodybuilding champion, for sure.
Wow. I'm surprised to hear that because you seem like a real clean-cut, nice guy. You know, I would never imagine you like in a motorcycle gang.
neither can I, quite frankly. And you know what's interesting is I still, literally up to about 2 years ago, one of my best friends who was in the club as well, had stayed in. I mean, up to 2 years ago, he was still in there, and I couldn't believe it. It's such a nice, sweet guy. You would never suspect it, and I just couldn't understand how he could remain in that lifestyle for that many years. And then ultimately, he had a revelation as well and had to get out. And about 2 years ago, and I got to tell you, it was, again, one of the greatest joys in my life to find that he had left the club, because I knew it's only a matter of time. You know, very few people walk away without going to prison or dead. And so I was thrilled to death. But, yeah, I am a nice guy, man. And if you say otherwise, I'm coming to get you.
Oh, that's crazy. What a story, though, man. That's unbelievable.
It was, I tell you, it was the catalyst. And that whole lifestyle did toughen me up a little bit. Because, you know, I mean, you got to get pretty callous and tough. And I witnessed some things that I certainly wouldn't, you know. And it was interesting because I had come from a very Catholic, Roman Catholic family. And I think what I was doing was rebelling. You know, I had when I was younger, even, you know, as a fourth grader, I was put into a special ed class. And that created, because I had dyslexia, and hyperactivity, I was fighting all the time. I had just moved to a new school, so I was fighting all the time. They didn't know what to do with me. So they put me in a special ed class. And that created, I think, the mindset and the self-doubt and the self-belief and the lower self-esteem, ultimately, that led to doing the whole thing with the whole motorcycle community. Because I thought you know, that whole community, is they call themselves the one percenters. And I felt like I was 1% of 1% of 1% of society being, you know, that kind of student and going through that ridicule and that painful period in my life where I was called retard and stupid and all these other things. You begin to believe it. And it began to manifest into something and grow into something, you know, like a fungus, you might say, that ultimately led to that lifestyle. But fortunately, there was something deeper down inside, a values, belief, and upbringing, and a loving family that ultimately helped me pull away from that as well, that led me to a greater path of certainly more service to myself and service to others as well. So I was blessed to be able to walk away from that.
Yeah, thank God you did. So when you got back into bodybuilding, did you, what was your plans? Did you say, I want to be a national champion? Because this was probably around the time the MPC was going, right, when you came back into bodybuilding.
Hadn't formulated. Well, I think it was formulating, but they were looking. Okay. I remember distinctly, I think I'd been back about a year, and my target goal, as soon as I got back out, was to win the Open Metropolitan Championship.
Okay.
And I knew, because I'd been told, I don't know how many times, about memory muscle tissue. I knew that even though I'd lost the vast majority of muscle, that it would come back pretty quickly, and I could capitalize on that and build upon that. And that's what I did. So within the first year, year and a half or so, that was my goal. And I think it took me about 2 years to win the open class at the Metropolitan. And that's about the time when a lot of the conflict was taking place between the AAU, the NPC was beginning to form. And I remember distinctly being either persuaded or asked. I think I was probably persuaded because I was an AAU competitor. So I think I was persuaded to a degree somehow, maybe it was by Wayne DeMille or someone, to vote for Jim Mannion, to get him in as the president, and to help organize, bring this new organization to fruition. And it's exactly what happened. So winning the Metropolitan Championship, then going on competing in some of those NPC shows, was the next step for me. And it was, I think you stayed, didn't you stay? You were AAU competitor primarily, weren't you, John?
Yeah, I was too, because I did my first show in 79, so it was all, I was in Chicago, so it was all AAU over there too.
Right, right, absolutely. Great, which was a great organization, you know?
Yeah, I mean, great memories of that, yeah.
And certainly, did you compete in Mr. America? I can't remember what, you did, didn't you? Because you won some great championships, man. I mean,
I did a lot of teenage shows in the AAU. I did like 10 teenage shows between 16 and 19 years old. And then took a couple of years off and bulked up. And then I did go into the AAU Mr. Illinois. And then I switched over to the NPC the next year. I did the NPC Illinois State. Yeah.
Wow.
So I never did the Mr. America. But I had a lot of friends that did the Mr. America.
Yeah.
A lot of guys from the gym, you know. Yeah.
Sure. Especially, you know, growing up there, and that was the NPC had a much stronger hold in that particular area.
But, yeah.
Yeah, the NPC did, you know, really help advance and grow the sport quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a point of stagnation where the only growth is adding more categories lengthening the shows to the point where it's almost insufferable.
Unbearable. People, right.
You know, right. Hard, man. But I own the NPC and the AAU.
Yeah, when the NPC started, it was still like a rivalry between the AAU and the NPC because some people were staying with the AAU and some people were – it took a couple of years, I think, before the NPC really took over.
I agree. Absolutely. That's right. And I think if you competed AAU, they wouldn't let you compete in NPC and or vice versa. I remember there was quite a bit of controversy over that. It was it made it a little difficult. I do remember that. And I remember, you know, the year I won – the national championship, I think it was, I might have been the first year it wasn't called the Mr. America. I think it was the first year it was the NPC National or American champion. I think it was the national championship. Which was, that might have been not the first year I won, not the year I won, but the first year I competed, I think, which was in 84 was my first year.
Okay.
And that was a memorable year competing in the national championship because it was down in – it was my first one. And, of course, you know, I had trained like a madman to be in this thing. And, of course, the anticipation going into the national championship or a Mr. America competition is you want to win, certainly. You know, as a champion, you always go in with the idea in mind that you're going to win. But making the top five would have been a fantastic accomplishment. That was really ultimately my goal. And I remember distinctly showing up in New Orleans, what I believe to be ready. I mean, I was about 195 pounds, dry as a bone. It was 1 week before. And the reason I'd gone down there 1 week before is because my training partner, a guy who took second in the USA 1 year, Gary Steinhardt, said he had some friends down there that were going to Tulane University. They were med students, and they could help me really get dry, really get ready. I mean, you'll be ready, you know? but I was already ready. And I remember, you know, doing some things that these guys were recommending because they knew what they were doing and wanting to kill them by the day of the contest because I could barely get out of bed. First off, it was like 110 degrees in New Orleans. It was an outdoor auditorium, which was brutal.
Wow.
But I remember being sick to my stomach. Cramping, every muscle in my body was cramping. I could hardly get out of bed, and had to go do battle. And I also remember distinctly once I got there, I didn't want to sit with these guys. I was like, you guys sit over there. I'm just sitting here by myself in the auditorium, in the outside auditorium, right? And I'm dripping sweat because it's so hot. And I remember distinctly they called the light heavy. I was watching the guys in the lightweights, and these guys look good. The middleweights look great. And they call the light heavies to get to backstage, start preparing, start pumping up, right?
Right.
So I remember I remember standing up in the auditorium, John, and first my right quadricep completely cramped. So I bent the leg to try and relax it, and then the hamstring cramp. And when then the left leg began to cramp up severely, and I fell down and rolled down three flights of stairs on the auditorium floor. It was unbelievable. I'm on my way to go get pumped, right? And
right.
So these guys, so my so-called friends at this point, my scientist friends, ran over. Thank God they were there, because they literally picked me up, carried me backstage. And I remember being carried backstage, watching the guys, like now in the light heavyweight division, and these guys are all popping up. They're getting ready. Right. They look good. They're oiling up, pop up. And I'm being carried backstage and laid down on the ground.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was brutal. It was brutal. And so they're like, I don't know what to do. I'm like, go. I grab one of the guys by the collar, and I'm like, go out there, grab me a hot dog and a beer.
Right.
They run down there as fast as he can. He comes back with the bun. I'm like, where's the hot dog? He says, I threw it in the garbage. You don't want to eat a hot dog. It's too much sodium. I'm like, I grab him again. I'm like, grab that freaking hot dog. So he reaches back in the garbage. I devour that hot dog. I pound down that beer. And it was just enough sodium, just enough carbohydrate to get me up onto my feet. No pump, no oil. And I get in the lineup, and I manage to get out on stage and can barely hold a flex. Like, I'd hit something, and it would start to cramp. I'd pull it back. Hit something, I start to cramp, pull it back again.
Oh, man.
And it was one of the most painful experiences in my bodybuilding career.
What did these guys do to you? Was it just training, or did they give you diuretics, or what did they do?
There was some diuretics, which I learned a powerful lesson from. I never again will I use diuretics, ever.
Right.
Some kind of diazide, and then we had to finish it up with some LASIK. Bad stuff. You know, I mean, just not good. And like I said, who knows? Maybe if I had been holding 15 pounds of water, you know, the week before, it might have worked, but not when
you were already ready.
Raw. I was already ready. I was dry.
Right.
I looked so much better. I looked so much better the week before. So how I took third, I will never know. But it was very fortunate. And I was up against some pretty good guys. Rich Gaspari was in that class. I think he took second.
Rich won, and Maldonado was second.
Yeah, Maldonado was second. Maldonado was good. He was in New York.
Yeah, he was a great bodybuilder. Yeah,
he really was. I remember.
You beat J.J. Marsh.
That's right. J.J. Marsh was in there. Man, those guys were good. I remember seeing them, and those were the guys I was looking at pumping up as I'm being carried backstage. I'm like, oh my god.
Right.
I mean, it's just, I might as well have just stayed home, as far as I can concerned at that point, you know. But
yeah, I'm looking at the list here. That John Kemper was in it. Casey Kucharik. Jerry Scalise, Nick Lavitola, Vinny Monaco, Mike Torture was 12th. James Hampton, remember him? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did. James was good.
Frank Pantoja, he was a great teenage competitor. He was in it.
Man, you remember all these guys. I do, too. It's just, they were strong. And I remember John Kemper. Later, John and I became friends. But I remember he was in the lineup with me, like right next to me. Mm-hmm. And I do remember him. He was also cramping pretty badly. He would come up into an ab shot, hit the ab shot, and then when he would come out, his abs would distend. Like, there was one row of abs that was just distending, like 2 inches out. They wouldn't release.
They just wouldn't come.
And he was like trying to lift his chest. He was trying to get it to release, and it was just I almost felt as bad for him as I felt for myself, because it was a rough one. It was a rough one.
Wow.
But man, those guys, J.J. Marsh, and J.J. Marsh and I had a little bit of a rivalry. After that, you know, because I beat him the next year, might have been even that year. I can't remember.
You beat him that year,
Beat him that year, and he didn't like me after that. He frequently called me Cracker. But JJ and I later became friends. He was a real great guy, but a very fierce competitor for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
I remember talking to Rich Gaspari about that contest, and Rich said he didn't get one first place vote. He got all second place votes. So I think you, Maldonado, and J.J. Marsh got the first place votes. It was split between you guys. But in the point totals, Gasparri won, I think, by 1 point because he didn't get one first place vote. Isn't that crazy?
Isn't that unbelievable? This is the guy who went on to become second place Mr. Olympia.
Yeah. You know, what did you think of Rich when you saw him that day?
You know what? Honestly, that day, this is why, you know, unless I go down the list, I can hardly remember because I was in such a state, honestly. I hardly remember anyone who was. I don't remember. I couldn't really size anybody up for the most part. Mm-hmm. I do remember Rich was good, but I didn't think he was that good. I thought he was a little blocky, you know, because at the night show I had a chance to see him pose. I thought he was a little bit blocky and didn't have great shape. He's not what I would call great genetics at that time.
Right,
you know,
like
some of the gifted bodybuilders we see, like a Matt Mendenhall at that time, had great genetics, you know. But I will tell you this, when I saw him compete in, was it Night of the Champions a year later?
Yeah,
next year. I was flawed. Albert Beckel beat him, but he deserved that show.
And I agree.
Because I think for the Nationals he weighed in maybe 195 or so. And and for the Night of the Champions, he must have come in there at 210, 215.
Yeah.
Just ripped to the bone, vascular like nobody you've ever seen, and extremely impressive. Impressive.
Yeah. And you went into the Junior USA that year too, right, Tom? And you won your class.
That's right.
You won the light heavyweights.
Yep. Yeah. The light heavy. I'm trying to remember who it was that won. It was the
Leon Brown on the overall.
Leon Brown. He was in the middleweights.
Yeah,
man, Leon Brown was a bit of a legend, wasn't he?
Yeah, for sure. In the original Pumping Iron book. Yeah.
That's right. He was a legend. And I remember, what a great guy. I tell you, you have never met a sweeter guy in your life. I mean, he was just one of the nicest guys. He was a New Yorker, just this really sweet guy.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind losing to Leon Brown in the least bit because he was a legend and he was a hell of a nice guy. And it was actually fun competing with him. It was a blast.
What year did you win the Metropolitan?
The open class?
Yeah.
Let me see. That would have been in, my first Nationals was in 84.
Right.
So I think that would have been around 83.
Okay.
I wish I had all these numbers in my head, but God forbid, you know. And I left all my trophies back in New York. And it was a whole room full. But I took one with me, the national championship. That was it.
Well, you did good. You did good in your first years in the Nationals. And I mean, you won your class at the Junior USA and then took third in the Nationals. And the Nationals was no joke back then. That was a tough, tough show.
It really was. No question about it. To beat Moses Maldonado was, that the year of winning it. And Moses, it was interesting. Moses, because I liked Moses and I knew Moses and I rooted like all hell for him when he competed in New York. But it was interesting because the year I took second at the Nationals, it was fun because I took third, second, and then won it the third year.
Right.
And I was competing against another light heavyweight who had won the overall, I believe, was Phil Williams.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil was good. Phil was really good. He had an amazing back. And I remember it was the evening show. And I remember because Phil and I got called out. They called out what we believed to be the top five. Phil and I were in that top five.
Okay.
And then they put everybody out, and they called Phil and I out together twice.
Wow.
And so we did battle, and it was everything you wanted to be. It was like, man, I've got to earn this, you know?
Right.
And we earned it. We were dripping. And so, you know, there was still a lot of hope going into the night show. And for me at the time, one of the things I put a tremendous amount of emphasis on is presentation, is the posing routine. I always put a lot of work into it.
Yeah.
Wanted it to be well choreographed to unusual music, maybe soundtracks from movies, stuff like that.
Oh,
so I
cool.
thought if it's that close, maybe my posing routine will push it over the edge, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember after the posing routine really having high hopes and, you know, listen, it could still go either way and I would celebrate for Phil one way or the other. But I do remember Moses coming up to me that evening and saying, man, you look great. Good job. It's too bad you took second. I'm like, what do you mean I took second? He goes, I'd already heard from one of the judges you took second. So this is before going out for the pose.
Yeah, before you posed, yeah.
So thank you, Moses, for deflating. I I was kind of a little pissed at Moses for that for a little while, but I also understand that some of his dreams of, you know, becoming Mr. Universe and turning pro were dashed, yeah, and he lost at the Universe and didn't really get another shot at it. And I'm sure he was hoping to get another shot at it. So I understand. We're all human. But at the time, I was a little peeved, you might say.
Yeah, because back then you had to not only win the Nationals, but then you had to go to the Mr. Universe and win your class there, right? Back
That's
in
right.
83, you, 84, 85, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I think 85 was the first year. 86, excuse me, was the first
86.
Year. You could go, you could turn pro, you could accept your pro card there, or go to the Universe.
Right.
And I was done. I was like, this, I've been dieting too hard. Mike Ashley, who took second, who was also a really great Long Island bodybuilder. In fact, he was like a surprise entry. I didn't know Mike was going to be in it. And I knew Mike was good, man. He was really good.
Yeah.
And so Mike, who took second, decided to go to the Universe. And that's where he earned his pro card. He won the Universe and became a great champ, a great pro. No question about it, man.
So analyze your physique back then, Tom. What would you say were your strong points and your weak points? I remember you had the really great legs and the really wide back when you did the front double back.
Yeah, I think that's probably the two strengths I had, the legs. And it's interesting, John, because my first national championship, my girlfriend was with me, and I had a few other friends, but my girlfriend was there who'd been to a lot of the contests and a lot of the shows that I'd been winning on the East Coast, and you know, a lot of it was based on legs because I had legs then, you know. And I remember because I knew I was in the top three, even with the cramping and all that stuff. And I remember asking her, "What'd you think?" And the first thing she said to me, she said, "Holy crap, everybody's got legs." I said, "No joke, J.J. Marsh, Rich Gasparri. I mean, they all had great legs, so I didn't have that advantage." But sort of, you know, analyzing my physique back then, good legs. The calves I thought were okay. Could have been a little bit better. They weren't a genetic gift by any means. Mm-hmm. Back was fairly thick and wide. I think it was mostly a balance to the physique and an aesthetic shape to it that I accentuated. I tried to accentuate through the posing and always Tony Pandolfo, who, again, didn't have the greatest genetics, but was a great physique competitor, taught me how to hide the weaknesses and accentuate the strengths in my posing. Mm-hmm. The thing that certainly was my Achilles heel at the time was my abs. I kind of equated my abs to sort of akin to a Boyer Coe.
Yeah.
Right? Remember Boyer? He never really
He
never had washboard abs, you know?
Right.
And neither did I. And even whatever little washboard I had, it was like kind of distorted. Like one was up here, one was down here, one was cockeyed. It was weird. It was a weird ab, a weird midsection. Yeah. I mean, when I did the ab pose, it would come out because I had decent serratus, intercostals, the obliques are okay. But the rectus abdominis itself was definitely not what we're looking at in terms of most of the physique competitors today. These guys have extraordinary abs. If you don't have extraordinary abs, don't even get up there, you know?
Right.
So that was my Achilles heel, and I trained those abs every bit as hard and every bit as frequently as anybody could have, but just genetically, they just weren't going to happen. They weren't there. So I think that was probably my weakness, maybe upper chest a little bit. All told, I probably could have used another 20 pounds easily. I think my heaviest in good lean shape was about 215. 225, 230 would have been nice, but again, it's one of those things where you work on it, you strive for it, and you hope like hell it's going to show up, and you do everything you can to make it happen, but putting those next 10, 15 pounds on was going to be a real challenge, no question about it, no question.
Yeah, it's great that you mentioned how the judges rewarded your aesthetics and your shape and stuff, because that was a big important part, as was the posing back then in the 80s.
Yeah, it really was. In fact, they used to do best poser trophies, remember that?
Yeah.
No.
And body parts. Remember the AU used to do body parts.
Right. Oh yeah, body parts.
Yeah.
If you won the show, if you were lucky enough to win the show, you went home with about 8 trophies, remember?
Right.
They were like, best arms, best legs, best poser.
Right,
you got it all.
Right.
Maybe somebody got one other trophy. Like,
man.
I don't know if I ever felt that good about that. You know, like, come on, give somebody else. I know this guy's arms are better than mine. Give him the arm trophy for crying out.
Right. You know? Right.
But it was fun. Well,
how did it feel winning the Nationals, Tom, after three tries? That had to feel great. I mean, because that kind of contest, man, it was so competitive. That had to feel unbelievable to win your class in that.
It really did, without question, especially, you know, after, I mean, the third try. And I knew, and it's interesting, John, because it was a little bit of a short story with that. I was, you know, after taking a third and then second, you know, you've got the momentum moving with you. And that's so important, as we know, in achieving anything, making it to the finish line. Momentum can be almost everything. And so I had that momentum. But it was really interesting because something happened, and I hope for your listeners that you can relate to this a little bit in terms of your own lives, and keeping an eye open, keep your radar elevated for this because it can happen to any of us at any time. Because if there's anything going on below the surface unconsciously with your level of self-esteem, and it doesn't have to be dramatic. You don't have to be in a gutter drinking your life away. I mean, you can have a self-esteem or a doubt issue or an uncertainty about what you're worthy of, what you're capable of, and what you deserve in life that can easily sabotage you achieving your greatness. And that's what my experience was going into that third year. Because I remember it was about 12 weeks, and I always started my training about 12, 14 weeks out. And I remember it was about 12 weeks out, and I just couldn't get my head there. It was like I had been running around with some new girlfriend and we were having fun. It was all summer long. And it was like, and I couldn't quite get it there. And it was just, I'm training and I'm eating, but it's just not happening. I didn't know what it was. And I remember just thinking to myself, oh, my God, I'm sabotaging myself. I've got this momentum. I can't let this happen. But I just couldn't seem to get it together. So out of the blue, and I hadn't seen Tony because I'd owned my own athletic clubs then for the last couple of years. So out of the blue, I called Tony Pandolfo, my mentor, the guy who owned Future Man Gym. And I said, Tony, I said, you're familiar with what's happening. He was still very heavily into the bodybuilding world. You're familiar with what happened. I took, you know, third and then second. I've got this momentum going forward, but I can't freaking get it together. I don't know what it is. I can't get my head into it. He didn't say anything. He didn't say, Tom, you need to do this. You need to do that, blah, blah. He just said, be in the freaking gym, Future Man, tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. That's it. Boom. For the next 12 weeks, he hammered me. He just made it so it was impossible not to have my head in the game. It was either have the head in the game or just freaking quit now. That's it. He was so intense and so fierce and so unrelenting and unforgiving that it was like I had no choice. And just having him there with me, the training partner I needed at that moment, it made all the difference in the world. So going into that contest with that momentum, having taken first, taken third, having wanted to take first the next year, but getting second, slight disappointment. And then training with Tony, going into this thing, facing Mike Ashley, who was a tremendous competitor from Long Island, didn't even know he was going to be in it. All of a sudden I see him weighing in. And then to finally have my name called in first was not only a tremendous relief that I got. I don't have to come back here and try this next year because, you know, next year Sean Ray won it. And I think we probably know what the outcome might have been if I had been in that light heavyweight division with Sean Ray. So there was some relief there that I don't have to come back and do this again. I've earned my pro card. And also just tremendous amount of, dare I say, pride and excitement about the journey that had come before that and the leaving the Outlaw Biker Club and now it manifesting into this tremendous championship. And it was really a moment that just, even when I think about it, it chokes me up a little bit, John. I mean, it's just one of those experiences.
When we have those moments in the competitions, we remember it forever. It just lasts forever. Yeah. You know, it's unbelievable.
Really do. And then you anchor that. I use that as an anchor in many respects for some of the other things that I've achieved that could be equated to some level of success. I mean, I feel that, you know, and I feel that like we all do, some doubt or uncertainty working on a project or moving forward with something. I reach back deep inside and reflect on that moment and what it took to get there. And that there was some doubt and there was some uncertainty along with that. And then it just, hey, we just make it happen. You just persevere and you push forward. And you collect yourself and you understand what you're worth and you just anchor. That's why I encourage people who are either in a contest and do well or even anchor the experience of training for it, getting up there and doing it, having the guts, having the balls to get up on that stage, regardless of the outcome. Anchor that experience into your body so you can call upon it at any time to help you get through the next challenge and the many more challenges you'll face along the way.
Yeah. I read this great article by Frank Zane once in Muscle Builder, and it was after he won, might have been after he won his first Olympia. And he was talking about having stage presence and charisma on stage. And I don't think at that time, well, he had already won the America and the Universe and stuff, but he drew on other bodybuilders that he saw. Like he saw Larry Scott win the Olympia the first time in 1965. And he remembers the unbelievable crowd reaction he got. And then he saw Arnold win the Olympia, I think it was in 74, because Zane was in that one. And he said the same thing. The charisma and the unbelievable crowd reaction. So when he was training for the 77 Olympia, the one he won, he remembered that and he tried to duplicate that kind. So even though he hadn't had the experience of winning the Olympia, he looked at what Larry Scott did. He looked at what Arnold did, and he tried to like take over that charisma that they had, you know, to adopt that. And then he did the same thing with the crowd that they did. And he didn't do it himself. He didn't do it from his own experience, but he did it because he took the experience of others, which I thought was really wild.
I think that's extraordinary. And Frank Zane has always been an inspiration of mine. And certainly, you know, it's fascinating because even our new Mr. Olympia is to me, I'm equating it to a degree, certainly not to the great degree that Frank Zane was Mr. Olympia following the era of Arnold Schwarzenegger, because Arnold Schwarzenegger, although aesthetic and beautiful in his own right, was a mass monster to a degree, at least in those times, right?
In that time,
and then it was Sergio Oliva, the mass monster before him. And then here comes Frank Zane, probably couldn't have weighed more than 180, 85 pounds winning the Olympia. And I kind of equate that to our new Mr. Olympia, more aesthetically appealing, a little bit better lines, a little bit more stage charisma, a little bit more putting it out there in terms of trying to please and create a show for the audience, you know? And I love that article. And I you know, I call that vicarious modeling. And when we can live, you know, you hear of living vicariously through someone else. Well, why not model vicariously through someone else and emulate their experience and then duplicate it, you know, in many respects.
Yeah.
And that's what Frank Zane did. And I had the pleasure as a teenager when I was competing. I mentioned I competed in the Southern USA down in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And Frank Zane was the guest pose. And I remember I was laying out on the beach by the lake, and it was just me out there. And Frank came along and said, "Hey, you mind if I join you?" And he threw his towel down next to me. And I thought, I had no clue what to say to this man. I mean, you know, 17 years old. It was like unbelievable that Frank Zane is laying next to me on the towel. I literally was dumbfounded. I could not say a word, you know? But he did say some encouraging things. "Hey, kid, you got a great physique. You can really mount something. You're in the competition. Good luck." And it was really a cool experience to meet Frank Zane. I idolized that guy. I thought, and he was the thinking man's bodybuilder too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
He really was. I mean, he taught us a lot. He's still brilliant.
He did everything right in order to win that title. Because like you said, he was a big guy. So he had to have everything perfect. You know, his posing, trunks. I mean, everything had to be right on, you know, in order for him to beat all those big guys. Yeah.
Yep. And you know what? You know what's another great lesson from Zane? And I'll throw myself into that mix a little bit. Having taken 3 years to win the national championship and not being willing to quit or give up and looking for and finding the resources. This is a lesson to find the resources you need. They're there. They're always there, but you have to be willing to look for them, to ask for them, to create them, to manifest them, and to recognize what you need in advance too. I recognized at that 12th week mark that this isn't going to happen on my own. I need to seek out a resource. And Tony Pandolfo was that resource, you know, Frank just it's such a great lesson that it's not going to happen. I mean, so many young athletes get frustrated after their first time or two and then wind up quitting when they've got tremendous potential. Frank could never have looked that good at that first Olympia that he won had he not had the multiple experiences, certainly winning the universe, but watching, being around, emulating, vicariously modeling the other great champions that came before him. That's what helped him bring it all together. So quitting on your first time, being frustrated, discouraged, nobody, it's very few people that can do it their first time out. It just doesn't happen. Right? Man.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs. And also thank Tom Terwilliger for joining us on the show. Next week, we will have part two of our interview with Tom Terwilliger, where he talks about competing as a professional bodybuilder, including two Mr. Olympias in 1989 and 1991, and also what he learned from competing in the sport of bodybuilding. If you have any comments on this episode, please email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes. And don't forget about that book offer that I'm offering all three of my books for only $50. So just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. That offer is good for one more week, guys. So get that in if you want to. naturalolympia@gmail.com. All three of my books for only $50. All right. That is it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Talk to you guys next week. Take care.